Ladies and gentlemen, in a moment marked by great joy and pride, we have come together in this National Big Gifts meeting of the Israel Emergency Campaign. We shall begin by rising and joining in the singing of the Hatikvah and then the Star-Spangled Banner. I am certain there have these two anthems meant more to us. We will be led in the singing by Cantor Saul Zimmel of New York City. And after the singing, I would ask that you remain standing for the invocation. It will be delivered by Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg, Temple Emmanuel, Shulman of Englewood, New Jersey. Will be delivered by Rabbi Charles Shulman of the Riverdale Temple of New York City.
God of our fathers, in this hour of anxiety and exaltation, we give thanks unto thee for the deliverance of our people in the land of Israel from the dangers that confronted them. We give thanks unto thee also for the strength and character of the Jews of the United States, who rose so magnificently in these hours to respond. We give thanks here for the representatives from all over these great states of this nation who are here tonight to assume the tasks that befall them in resuscitating that which has been so badly wounded in the state of Israel. And above all, we give thanks to the knowledge that we are a people, one people, a Jewish people, and that the fate of one determines the fate of all. And we will not let our people down anywhere in the world after the difficulties that we have endured in these past days of our years. Reverently, in this hour, we invoke thy blessing upon the bread that we break. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam hamotzi lechem min haaretz. Amen.
I like it. I'm very glad it's mine. No, I got a real beauty. Oh, you got one too. Oh, Joe, start the other side. Push over to Eddie.
Ladies and gentlemen, will you please take your seats? May I have your attention? Ladies and gentlemen, we have a most distinguished dais, and I wish to introduce our guest to you. I shall omit the names of those whom I'll introduce when they speak. Starting on my left, Herbert Friedman, Executive Director at UJA. Please withhold your applause till after they're all through. Jack Weiler, National Chairman of UJA. Jack, where are you? Jack's probably out soliciting gifts. Jack? Here he is. Jake Fulton's not here. Isidore Breslau. Not him. Louis Fox, President of the Council of Jewish Welfare Federation. Albert Parker, National Chairman of UJA. Louis Brodo, Chairman of JDC. Louis? Alfred Morris, member of the UJA Executive Committee. Samuel Hausman, Honorary Chairman of the New York UJA. Joseph Shane, National Chairman of UJA. Leonard Ratner, member of the UJA Executive Committee. Joseph Mazur, member of the UJA Executive Committee. Larry Schack, member of the UJA Executive Committee. Paul Zuckerman, member of the UJA Executive Committee. Leonard Strelitz, UJA Executive Committee. Alan Sagner, also member of the Executive Committee. Nahum Shamir, Economic Minister of the State of Israel, the United States. Leonard Bell, Chairman of the Young Leaders Cabinet. And Phil Zinman, National Chairman. From my right, Eddie Ginsberg, Associate General Chairman. Dewey Stone, Chairman of the UJA. Charles Bassine, Trustee of the New York UJA. Eddie Warburg, President of New York UJA and a former General Chairman. Joe Meyerhoff, former General Chairman of the UJA, Chairman of the Israel Education Fund. Mrs. Harry Jenny Jones, Chairman of the UJA National Women's Division. Melvin Dubinsky, member of the UJA Executive Committee. Roy Hoffberger, member of the UJA. Roy Hoffberger, Baltimore. Merrill Hossenfeld, member of the UJA Executive Committee. Israel Fink, UJA National Chairman. Joseph Cantor, member of the UJA Executive Committee, National Chairman. Bernard Barnett, member of the UJA Executive Committee. Barney. Adolph Kiesler, member of the UJA Cabinet Campaign. The grand old gentleman from... Abraham Goodman. Albert Edelman, National Chairman of UJA. Ambassador Michael Arnon, Consul General for Israel to the New York City. My great and wonderful friends of the American Jewish community, we meet in the midst of history to make more history. We are here from all of the corners of our great land to show in the name of American Jews our love and our affection and our concern and our great pride in the people of Israel in their finest hour. Meanwhile, all over this country, similar emergency fund meetings are taking place. There are no words to express all that is in our hearts tonight. 1 week ago, the 2.5 million Jews of Israel seemed to stand on the very brink of annihilation. 1 week ago, every Jew in the free world went about with a prayer in his heart for his people who were besieged and beleaguered and threatened in their homeland. And now, just 1 week later, we know, each of us, that we have seen a miracle of deliverance come to pass. how do we describe how great is our pride and our joy in the men and women of Israel, the soldiers, the civilians, and the brave people who created this miracle? How does one say how great is our thankfulness, our sense of privilege, that in our time we have been permitted to witness and to participate in the birth and now the rebirth of Israel and the people of Israel? The people of Israel, with whom by common heritage and by shared experience and by fate and by choice, to whom we are forever united. It is not my purpose tonight to speak long. The real voice and the great voice of the American Jewish community will be heard from you who are here tonight, just as the real voice and a great voice of America, of Israel's people, will be heard from later our special guest of the evening. But I do wish to tell you about two of the proudest moments of my life. Both of them occurred within the last 18 days. Friday, May 26, together with Herb Friedman, I stepped from a plane at Lida into a besieged and mobilized Israel. We were there because Herb, with his special sixth sense, understood we were needed and said it was urgent that we come. For 6 hours, we met with Israel's leaders, with Prime Minister Eshkol, Finance Minister Sapir, Louis Pincus, Chairman of the UJ of the Jewish Agency, and many others. And our urgent conclusion was there had to be the great emergency effort which brings you here tonight. But the moment I shall never forget, and the one I shall always treasure, is the moment we stepped from the plane when the people at the airport and the people we met everywhere saw us and said, "They are here. The American Jews are here. They have come. In a critical hour, and in your name, I was able to bring a message of complete support, and I was able to assure them that American Jews would give their full help and support." I was never more privileged and never more honored. The second proud moment of which I speak is this. This one. Yes, this one. We have come here tonight to show by our presence and our giving all we feel for Israel and its great people. But we do not come here tonight wondering what the response will be. We know what it has been and what it will be, how great it has been and how wonderful it will be. A week ago, the United Jewish Appeal, together with a Council of Jewish Federations and the Jewish Communities of America, called for a great Israel Emergency Fund. 1 week ago, a spark was set and a great fire took hold throughout this land. A great Jewish community mobilized, took up its positions, and began to do its duty, responding in a day and even in hours. Never, never in the history of this country has there been such initial response to a call for support. As your chairman, one who is privileged to be part of the wonders that you created through the United Jewish Appeal and the Israel Emergency Fund, I can only tell you I am very proud of what each one of you has done. Meanwhile, there are a million Jewish men and women and children across this land whom I wish I could thank by name tonight. I would like to thank the many persons who took their savings and turned them over to the Emergency Fund. I would like to thank the thousands of normally modest contributors who stood up and said, "Put me down for $25,000 and $50,000 or $100,000. And I'd like to thank the larger contributors who in a flash became ultra-larger contributors who went from tens of thousands to the hundreds of thousands and even millions. I would like to thank all the members of the UJA's wonderful executive committee and all of the UJA's wonderful leaders. They are tremendous. They showed how they felt when they immediately made their own gifts and then began manning the phones on a round-the-clock basis in our office and in their home communities to get in the big gifts and get the campaign started. I would like to thank as well all the presidents and leaders and the executive directors of the communities across the country. My thanks go to the Israel Bond Organization, to the presence of all the many other cooperating organizations, and last but not least, the wonderful UJA professional staff who turned in a sensational job marked by organization and dedication. May I say simply, you are truly a marvelous people, all of you. But there are some that I must mention by name. I want to thank Finance Minister Sapir and Louis Pincus of the agency. We called, and they came. They're not with us tonight because they're still in the field raising money. Let me thank Chaim Laskov, former chief of staff, who broke off his speaking tour to get back where he was needed even more. And then, let me thank especially Herb Friedman, who moved first and fast and hard to get the emergency fund launched. Our thanks to Herb Friedman. And then to Eddie Ginsberg, my associate general chairman, who showed the great qualities of leadership that he has. Lou Fox, president of the council. And Phil Bernstein, its executive director, who moved so quickly and effectively, who understood and said, it's all out for Israel. Our thanks to you, Phil. In one sense, nothing we have done can be compared to the glory and the honor which the people of Israel and its defense forces have earned. What they did at the risk of their lives is incomparable. But let us understand that in 7 days of extraordinary campaigning, all of you and the American Jewish community as a whole have also brought honor and glory to the word Jew. Your speed, your deeds represent the greatest voluntary response ever in the history of this country or in the world. We tonight mean to keep up that advance. We mean to continue to act, to continue to demonstrate what Israel and our people mean to us. We Jews have an obligation put on us from ancient times to ransom the captives. But tonight, we do not give to buy out captives. Tonight, we give as free men to free brothers to make certain that never again shall there be captives. Only Jewish men and women living in freedom. Thank you. You'll excuse me while we bring in our guest of honor.
Friends, things have not happened so quickly only in Israel, but it seems that every hour and the hour almost, we get news more exciting, sometimes more shocking. than what we knew before. In Israel, we again, after 10 years of the Sinai campaign, were again faced with a danger to our security and our very existence in what NASA announced that this time it was going to be a total war of annihilation of Israel. Only 2 or 3 days before the fighting started, his chief of staff, speaking to his soldiers, said, "This is the holy war, and Israel must be annihilated. And the entire world is waiting for the success of this war." For over 2 weeks, we lived with the large Israel army at our doorstep in the Sinai campaign. For over 2 weeks, we knew that more and more tanks were coming into the Sinai desert. The very Sinai desert that we were forced to evacuate 10 years ago. We knew that in the Gaza Strip, in the city of Gaza, again, the Egyptian army was massed, ready to attack. The same Gaza that only 10 years ago we were forced to leave, being promised that the Egyptians will not occupy Gaza, that Gaza will be occupied, will be under UN administration. Sharm el-Sheikh, we were forced to leave. But the free passage of Israel vessels will be guaranteed by having UN observers there. And so in 1967, to my sorrow, to my shame maybe, it was I that appeared at the United Nations as Foreign Minister, making the announcement on behalf of my government that we accept these promises and hopes and assumptions by what is called the family of nations and the maritime powers, and we are leaving all these places. What happened in 1967, you know. It was much the exit of the UN observers from the Sinai, from the Gaza Strip, from Sharm el-Sheikh was much quicker than their entrance. And then the announcement came, no Israel shipping. The Sinai, full of over 100,000 Egyptian soldiers, over 1,000 tanks of the best. We knew of hundreds of planes that were in possession of Egypt itself, but in this war they're going to join also with Syria and Jordan and Iraq. We knew the number of airfields that Egypt alone possessed, from which these hundreds of planes will take off. I'm sure it was no military secret to Egypt nor to Syria, the very small number of airfields that Israel has. And we waited, knowing that it may come any day, hoping against hope that the family of nations will remember its little member of the family, a little country in the Middle East, the State of Israel, set up after the family of nations and the United Nations decided that after what happened, especially in the Second World War, there should be a Jewish state. And we thought we would be remembered and not forgotten. This little country of 2.5 million, surrounded by 40, 50 million, armies very well equipped, ready to attack. We waited until the morning came and Israel started, and Egypt started to move. We, of course, are now the imperialists. We are the aggressors. We are criminals. You're watching television. You listen to speeches of senior members of the family of nations, speaking only, of course, from justice and the right of people, giving advice in the Security Council. Evidently, it was not only in the Security Council where their advice was given. I heard over the television, the same as you did, that there were advisors from the same source somewhere else in Syria who seem to be now in Israeli possession. This is the world in which we live. Not hundreds of years after the Holocaust of Hitler. Only 25 years after that. We are a people, we do not want wars, we don't want victories in wars. We have a very small country, we don't ask for any more territory. We have enough sand, enough rocks to do our job. We have even proven that in the last 20 years we can do something with these rocks and sand. But in the last 20 years, this was the third time when we had to send our sons to war. And I can almost point out families. Who of the family fought in 1948? And a younger brother in 1956? And a younger brother in 1967? And the question is, do we have to now begin to train the little ones of 9 and 10 years old? Maybe we will be allowed to live in peace for another 10 years, but they must be prepared, definitely, that in 10 years from now, they, as their elder brothers, must go to war. And even in a war of victory, not everybody comes back. Victory is not achieved without the loss of lives. And so we don't want to be killed, and we don't want to kill, and we want to live in peace. But it depends entirely upon our neighbors. When there is war, whether we win or lose, depends upon us. Depends upon these sons, and depends upon their mothers, and their young wives. And I'm sorry that not every one of you was in Israel during these weeks. Before the fighting broke out and during those 3 wonderful days when we walked around and didn't know exactly how many hours since it started, because it seemed impossible. Even miracles must take time to happen. The discipline, the lack of any sign of panic or fear, the readiness of each one to do what he can. We were not always very complimentary about our youngsters. We always think they're not quite what they should be, until the day comes when they have to prove themselves. And they have never failed. But those men and women that were left in the cities, the mothers, the fathers, those that have just come in a few years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, 6 months ago, a year ago into the country, some who have come to the country with their memories very fresh of what war means. And we thought that maybe they'll be afraid. Maybe they'll be afraid to let their sons go. But not one single case do we know of in the country were the reserve, those in the reserve army that were called up and did not come. Immediately, on the dot, there was trouble in one place. The commander of that spot had trouble. 110% came. And the extra 10% who weren't called up because of their physical condition demanded medical examination there and then to prove that they can do it. The first few hours on Monday, when news came through of hundreds of Egyptian planes that came up towards Israel, and of the Egyptian, of the Israeli pilots knocking out the planes in the air and those that have not yet taken off. And it seemed really like a dream. Monday and Tuesday, Monday night we went up to Jerusalem to a meeting of the Knesset to hear a statement from the Prime Minister and to have three new ministers sworn into government. We couldn't go up the regular road to Jerusalem because of the shelling from our Jordanian neighbor. He too wanted to come in and have a share in the annihilation of Israel. And for days, Jerusalem was shelled. And I think that you will probably, we all will hear very soon, it will be said to us that Jerusalem is a holy city to three great religions in the world. But it was also last Monday and Tuesday. It was also in 1948 when it was shelled. But out of the three great religions, there were people only of one that defended Jerusalem in 48 and defended it now in 67. And after the war in 48, in an agreement with Jordan, it was agreed, the armistice agreement, that we shall have free access to all religious places in the old city, as well as to Mount Scopus, to the university, to the hospital. And there it was, signed voluntarily by representatives of Jordan. So what? And for 20 years, we had no access to our religious places. We had no access to Mount Scopus. No access to the Wailing Wall. Until 2 or 3 days ago. Until after the shelling of the new city from the walls of the old city. Friday morning, 2 or 3 hours before I left Israel to come here, I thought I couldn't leave the country, and here it was possible to go to the old city of Jerusalem, and it was possible to go to the Kotel HaMaravi, and I shouldn't go, I just couldn't. We went to Jerusalem, and went to the old city, and went to the Kotel HaMaravi. One does not have to be especially religious in order to feel that he's standing in the face of a turning point in history when he stands face to face with the Wailing Wall, that massive, great wall. The remains and reminder of what we once were and of our destruction and dispersion. But there it stands. Not everything was destroyed. We were not wiped out. There this wall remains, massive, strong, indestructible. as it was to say to the Jewish people and to the world, they'll come back. This wall will not be only a remainder of what was, it will also be a sign of what will be. Into the old city, our boys also didn't come in just by marching in. Lives were lost. And the first to march in, to break through, are always paratroopers. And I saw some of them early Friday morning at the Wailing Wall, a service. These paratroopers in their uniforms, their Sten guns on a table there, put away temporarily. This happened to be a group of Nachal, of religious youngsters, paratroopers. Their tzitzis were showing out from under their jackets. It was the morning prayer with the tefillin, with the talasim, with the praying shawls. I was told beforehand by Brigadier Chaim Herzog how they fought. They didn't weep. They were not afraid. But when they stood in front of the Wailing Wall, they wept. Wept for joy, maybe also a tear for their comrades that fell in battle. But the great joy that there they are again. And one thing is certain, never again will the road to the Wailing Wall be closed to Jews. And never again will there be Jordanian soldiers or any other soldiers on the wall of the old city so that it shall be convenient for them to shoot and shell the new city. And never again will the border between Gaza and Israel be such that it will be the source of infiltrees and the constant danger to the villages on this side of the border. And on the Syrian border, I understand now why the representative of the Soviet Union is so angry with us. If it is true what was reported, and the report was not by Israelis, but the report was by your reporters here, that there are Russian advisors who were together with the Syrian army and are now in Israel, caught by Israelis during the battle. If that is true, then I can understand and sympathize with him, and I can understand his anger. Not only Soviet tanks were sent to Syria and to Egypt for the humanitarian purpose of killing off Israelis, not only MiGs, not only Topolovs and Ilyushins, but men, advisors, how to kill, how to destroy, how to eliminate. In great heroism, on top of the hills, when Tel Katzir and Ein Gev and Lahavot HaBashan and Dan and Gadon are all down there in the valley, you can see them like on the palm of your hand. Is it a wonder that in some of these villages there isn't one single building that wasn't shelled? Is it a wonder that one or two of them are entirely without buildings? Thank God, no casualties. But I ask you, women that are sitting here, how long is it morally right to expect of mothers to raise their children in air shelters? Because not only when there is a war, are these villages being shelled? This happens several times a year, sometimes for days, because these heroes are on top Not one single child was evacuated from any one of these villages. Not one single mother asked for her child to be evacuated. And now, that those hills are in the possession of Israel. It may be. It's perfectly true. It's on the border or even a bit beyond the border. The question was either to cross the border or to tell our people in the valley that there is no border for them, that the shells from the Syrian guns can reach them without any obstruction whatsoever. That was the border. That was the limit. And if we can help it, if it's only within our physical power, and it is, unless not only advisors come, but never are we going to allow that those children down in that valley, in the Hula area, in Galilee, near the Kinneret, never will we leave those hills and allow those children to live in constant danger. And so we've gone to war, not because we wanted to. It was a question, whose planes are knocked out first? And thank God, our pilots got there first. And we want the war, but we want peace. And there are two big problems that are facing us at this moment. Much has been destroyed in the city of Jerusalem and in the villages. The villages in the Syrian border, some on the Jordanian border. This has to be rebuilt, and rebuilt rapidly. We have one more problem. We have a good memory. We know what happened 10 years ago. I don't know when, today, tomorrow, 3 days from now, the pressure will begin. Despite our experience in the family of nations, we try to save ourselves from becoming cynical. And we still have faith in the decency of individuals and of heads of states. And we know that we have friends. We have enemies, but we have friends. And I want to believe that we can depend upon them. And I want to believe that they will realize it is not decent, it is not moral to ask a people like us to be prepared at best for war only once in 10 years. And then, from time to time, only mines, only shelling, only railroads blown up, water pipes. Well, that really doesn't amount to so much. For that, you don't go to war. And war, really, only once in 10 years. That's not so terrible either. You have 10 years of peace. I hope people will understand that they can't expect that of us. But we know we have one great ally. We don't have to ask. We don't have to speculate. He's there. I said last night in the Madison Square Garden, I'm convinced the paratroopers that broke their way through into the old city of Jerusalem knew two things. One, they weren't doing it only for themselves, not even only for the Israelis. They were breaking through a road for the Jewish people. And what's more, they knew that they weren't there alone, that the Jewish people were with them. We felt that in all these days, and we know it now. I don't think that ever was there such enthusiasm, but not superficial enthusiasm. Never was enthusiasm and identification so deep, so absolute between Jewish people all over the world and Israel as it is at this present moment. And that, not only in the United States. Wherever there are Jews, on my way here, I stopped for an hour in Paris, and I met our ambassador there. He told me the most fantastic stories. I've been here only a few days. I've been to Los Angeles yesterday morning. I was in Madison Square Garden last night. I know of telephones, of people that come in, of letters that I receive. There is no more theorizing about the oneness. I think every Jew, every Jewish man and woman felt, if Israel goes down, it affects him personally. It's not merely a theoretical belonging. There is something much more personal, much more close than that. My friends, I think you would have been proud of us had you seen us during those days. At any rate, we are proud of you, of this communication without words, without telling you what is at stake, without alerting you. This is something spontaneous. When something happens in the family, you don't send cables to each other and you don't hold speeches for each other. You know what's happening. You know that first of all, the family must get together. And this is what has happened to the Jewish communities all over the world. To us, there is no other source of strength than this. Look, a war has to be fought with planes and with tanks and with guns. A war is won at the cost of lives of young men that should have lived. They had the world before them. It is so senseless. There's no excuse for it. Why? Here we are in our very small strip of sand, rocks, a little bit of decent soil, working hard for those that are there, those that are coming, and those many that will come. Why? But here it is. I went down to see my daughter's kibbutz in Rivivim 2 weeks ago Saturday. I didn't know when Nasser would start attacking, and I thought right close to the border, I should go down and say hello. And I saw the entire group, the hundreds of members of the kibbutz, not a sign of fear. Everyone knew exactly what he had to do. My granddaughter of 14 and a half knew that for her there is no room in the air shelter. The air shelter is only for younger children. It is her duty to take the little ones into the air shelter, but she can't go in because it'll be too full. My grandson, yes, he's younger, but she not. She's too old for that. Everybody knows exactly what he has to do, what his assignment is. We met for about 10 minutes before I came back to Tel Aviv. But a woman walked over to me, and she spoke in Yiddish, a newcomer. She came to me and she said, "Here, I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. Everybody cares for me. I'm assigned to a place where I would be safe. I'm not afraid. I was afraid. I knew what fear was during the war when I was among strangers. But here I'm not afraid. For these that are there, that should forget fear, even in moments of danger. For those that will come, so that there will be a home. For them we must assure peace and hope and freedom and life for children in Israel, that may they never know victories in war, because may they never know war.